Dr. D ended up implementing the procedure in a unique way. He continued to split the breastbone of his patients, albeit with a smaller incision. One of his nurses remarked, "Dr. D is a creature of habit." And the old habits eventually won out. The use of the new procedure gradually dwindled, and eventually it was abandoned. Across the hospitals she studied, Edmondson found that the teams who failed made the mistake of trying to get it right on the first try, and were motivated by the chance to perform, to shine, or to execute perfectly. But of course, no one shines on the first few tries. This mindset set the teams up for failure. By contrast, the successful teams focused on learning. They didn't assume that mastery would come quickly, and they anticipated that they'd face challenges. In the end, they were the ones who were more likely to get it right. Failing is often the best way to learn, and because of that, early failure is a kind of necessary investment. A famous story about IBM makes that point well. In the 1960s, an executive at IBM made a decision that ended up losing the company $10 million, about $70 million in 2009 dollars. The CEO of IBM, Tom Watson, summoned the offending executive to his office at corporate headquarters. The journalist Paul B. Carroll described what happened next. As the executive cowered, Watson asked, "Do you know why I've asked you here?" The man replied, "I assume I'm here so you can fire me." Watson looked surprised. "Fire you?" he asked. "Of course not. I just spent $10 million educating you." 12. In 1995, Molly Howard, a longtime special education teacher in Louisville, Georgia, watched as the new Jefferson County High School building was being built. "Every day I'd drive by the building and I'd wonder, who's going to run that school? And it kept tugging at me. Why don't you apply?" Howard said. She applied and got the job, but with the promotion came a very tough challenge. 80% of the school's students lived in poverty. Only 15% of students in the previous high school had continued on to college. "The kids you'd expect to be successful were successful," said Howard. "But what about the other 85%? Many teachers had a nearly defeatist attitude. There was this belief that some children can and some children can't, that we're here for the ones who can get it, and we've got to accept that we're going to lose some. I knew I'd have to challenge that," said Howard. Howard acted quickly. First, she had to sell a new identity. Howard believed that every student could aspire to go to college, so she abolished the school's two-track system that had separated college-bound students from vocational students. In her school, everyone would share the college-bound identity. She beefed up assessments and tutorial programs. She matched students with teachers who'd be their on-campus advisors through all 4 years. Perhaps her most distinctive change, though, was to the grading system. Under her new system, the only grades offered at Jefferson County High School were A, B, C, and NY. Not yet. In Howard's view, the students at Jefferson had accepted a culture of failure. In a fixed mindset way, they acted as though they were failures to the bone. Students often didn't do their homework, or they turned in shoddy work. Getting a D or an F was an easy way out, in a way. They might get a poor grade, but at least they would be done. In the new system, the students couldn't stop until they'd cleared the bar. "We'd define up front to the kids what's an A, B, and C," said Howard. "If they do substandard work, the teacher will say, 'Not yet.' That gives them the mindset, 'My teacher thinks I can do better.' It changes their expectations." The school was reborn. Students and teachers became more engaged. The school's graduation rate increased dramatically, and student test scores went up so much that remedial courses were eliminated. In 2008, the National Association of Secondary School Principals declared Howard the U.S. Principal of the Year out of 48,000 candidates. Howard transformed her students. She cultivated a new identity in them. "You're all college-bound students." Then she flipped Jefferson from a fixed-mindset school to a growth-mindset school. She believed that every student was capable of doing acceptable work, that no student was doomed to failure. There's no never at Jefferson anymore, only a not yet. 13. In times of change, we need to remind ourselves and others again and again of certain basic truths. Our brains and our abilities are like muscles. They can be strengthened with practice. We're not born skateboarders or scientists or nurses. We must learn how to skateboard, do science, or care for sick people. And our inspiration to change ourselves comes from our desire to live up to those identities. In the story of Molly Howard, we see that amazing things can happen when you combine the aspiration of a new identity with the persistence of the growth mindset. That's how you grow your people. Over the past few chapters, we've seen that the central challenge of change is keeping the elephant moving forward. Whereas the rider needs direction, the elephant needs motivation. And we've seen that motivation comes from feeling. Knowledge isn't enough to motivate change, but motivation also comes from confidence. The elephant has to believe that it's capable of conquering the change. And there are two routes to building people's confidence, so that they feel big relative to their challenge. You can shrink the change, or grow your people, or preferably, both. Our picture of change is still incomplete, though, because it's clear that in some situations, even a reluctant elephant and a confused rider will manage to change their behavior. For instance, consider the fact that even a lost, angry driver who is hopelessly late for an appointment will stop dutifully for a red light. That's why, to make changes stick, we've got to think about shaping the path. Shape the path. Chapter 8. Tweak the environment. 1. When some guy cuts you off in traffic, you probably think instinctively, "What a jerk." Or perhaps your inner voice is more vulgar. What you almost certainly don't think to yourself is, "Gosh, I wonder what's wrong that he is in such a hurry." It's not hard to see why we don't think that. It seems kind of naive, as if we're making an excuse for a bad person. But think about your own behavior. Think of a time when you were driving so crazily that others would have been justified to curse you. Was your crazy driving on that day a manifestation of your true character, i.e., you're a jerk to the core? Or was it sparked by the situation you were in? In the very first story in Chapter 1, about moviegoers who ate more popcorn when given bigger buckets, we saw how easy it can be to jump to conclusions about people. If we hadn't known about the effect of bucket size, it would have been easy to conclude that the big bucket people were popcorn-gorging gluttons. But of course, the surprising part of the study is that when you give people a giant bucket, they become popcorn-gorging gluttons. And when someone behind the wheel of a car is 20 minutes late for a crucial appointment, that person becomes a terrible driver. What looks like a person problem is often a situation problem. The same phenomenon holds true in the business world. W. Edwards Deming, the chief instigator of the total quality management movement that revolutionized manufacturing, told a story about a company that used a variety of flammable products in its production process. Unsurprisingly, fires frequently broke out in its plants. But the president of the company didn't think he had a situation problem. He thought he had a person problem. He sent a letter to every one of the company's 10,500 employees, pleading with them to set fewer fires. What looks like a pyromania problem is often a flammable chemical problem. We are frequently blind to the power of situations. In a famous article, Stanford psychologist Lee Ross surveyed dozens of studies in psychology and noted that people have a systematic tendency to ignore the situational forces that shape other people's behavior. He called this deep-rooted tendency the fundamental attribution error. The error lies in our inclination to attribute people's behavior to the way they are rather than to the situation they are in. The fundamental attribution error complicates human relationships. Marriage therapist Michelle Wiener Davis said, "Most people attribute their marital problems to some deeply ingrained personality characteristics of their spouse. A wife might say, 'My husband is a stubborn person.' But Wiener Davis might respond, 'You've got to admit that your husband isn't always stubborn. He doesn't resist when his coworkers suggest a new client approach at work, and he doesn't drag his feet when you propose new ways to handle the family's finances. The stubbornness emerges mainly when you suggest a new approach with the kids at home, and when you do that, he is stubborn almost every time.' It's the situation, not an immutable stubbornness built into his character, that produces the behavior. This doesn't excuse his stubbornness, of course, but it should provide hope for a solution, since situations should be easier to tweak than people's core character. The fundamental attribution error is the reason why we love TV shows like The Dog Whisperer or Supernanny, in which seemingly irredeemable dogs and kids are tamed by outsiders who come in with a new system of discipline. At the beginning of the episodes, we're presented with a dog that bites everything in sight, or a child who won't obey the simplest of commands, and we simply can't avoid jumping to conclusions about their character. That dog is vicious. That boy's a terror. And when they're reformed in the course of a short intervention, it blows our minds. If we could cure ourselves of the fundamental attribution error, these shows would seem obvious to the point of absurdity. It would be like watching a show whose premise was that if you take scalding hot liquids, dangerous and slippery, and stick them in the freezer for a long time, they renounce their fiery former selves and turn to ice. Now you can see why the third element of our framework, the path, is so critical. If you want people to change, you can provide clear direction, rider, or boost their motivation and determination, elephant. Alternatively, you can simply make the journey easier. Create a steep downhill slope and give them a push. Remove some friction from the trail. Scatter around lots of signs to tell them they're getting close. In short, you can shape the path. 2. To see how a smoother path can change behavior, consider some research that studied why college students did, or didn't, donate food to a canned food drive for charity. The researchers knew some students would be more charitable and generous than others, and would be more inclined to donate food. The researchers wondered, can we alter the situation so that jerks give, too? First, to distinguish saints from jerks, they polled all the students in a particular dorm, asking them to assess which of their dorm mates, out of roughly 100, were most likely and least likely to make a donation. Once they compiled those rankings, they had a pretty good idea of which students were charitable or uncharitable types. Then they altered the path. Some students received a basic letter announcing the launch of a food drive the following week and asking them to bring canned food to a booth on Tresidder Plaza, a well-known spot on campus. Other students received a more detailed letter, which included a map to the precise spot, a request for a can of beans, and a suggestion that they think about a time when they'd ordinarily be near Tresidder Plaza so they wouldn't have to go out of their way to get there. The two letters were randomly sent to the saints and the jerks. A week later, after the food drive was over, the researchers had a precise list of who had given food and who hadn't. The students who received the basic letter were not very generous. Only 8% of the saints donated, and not a single one of the jerks. So far, the jerks were living up to their reputation, but the saints weren't exactly outperforming. Then came the shock. Students who received the more detailed letter were substantially more charitable. 42% of the saints donated, and so did 25% of the jerks. This is an inspiring result. These researchers got 25% of the worst individuals in the dorm to donate simply by smoothing the path a bit. Bottom line, if you're hungry and need a can of food, you're three times better off relying on a jerk with a map than on a budding young saint without one. What's more, the path wasn't changed in any dramatic way. The letter just gave moderately more concrete instructions. Imagine what would have happened with a more aggressive intervention. What if volunteers had gone door to door collecting the canned food? What looks like a people problem is often a situation problem, and no matter what your role is, you've got some control over the situation. 3. Today, as you go through your day, notice how many times people have tweaked the environment to shape your behavior. Traffic engineers wanted you to drive in a predictable, orderly way, so they painted lane markers on the roads and installed stoplights and road signs. Grocery store managers wanted you to spend more time in their store, so they positioned the milk coolers all the way at the back. Your boss's boss wanted to encourage more collaboration among employees, so she approved an open floor plan layout with no cubicles or dividers. The bank was tired of your leaving your ATM card in the machine, so now the machine forces you to remove it before you can claim your cash. Tweaking the environment is about making the right behaviors a little bit easier and the wrong behaviors a little bit harder. It's that simple. As an inspiration, think about Amazon's one-click ordering. With one-tenth the effort of dialing a phone number, you can buy a new book or DVD. Talk about instant gratification. Amazon site designers have simply made a desired behavior, you spending money on their site, a little bit easier. They've lowered the bar to a purchase as far as humanly possible, at least until they launch one-blink ordering. By doing this, they've generated untold millions of dollars in incremental revenue. The opportunities are endless for simple one-click style tweaks. A few years ago, a consultant named Peter Bregman was asked to help a management consulting firm with an administrative problem. Employees weren't submitting their timesheets on time, which slowed the firm's billing because charges to clients were based on hours worked. Traditionally, the consultants had submitted their timesheets on paper, and they'd done so pretty reliably. Then, the firm developed an online timesheet tool. Consultants weren't using it. The executives held education classes to explain the new tool, but people kept on submitting their timesheets on paper. Frustrated, the executives tried using fiat power, announcing that the new online tool was mandatory. That worked for about half of the employees, said Bregman. The rest simply ignored it. The executives were ready to escalate the battle. They prepared a memo saying that people wouldn't get their paychecks unless they used the online tool. Side note. In our experience, people who are trying to change things often reach instinctively for carrots and sticks. But this strategy indicates a pretty crude view of human behavior, that people act only in response to bribes and punishments. And it quickly becomes absurd. Are you going to break out the no paycheck stick for every change you want to make in your workplace? Bregman put the brakes on. Wait, he said. Do we know why people aren't doing the online timesheet? The executives assumed that the consultants were Luddites, or simply, obstinate. Classic labels inspired by the fundamental attribution error. Bregman persuaded the executives to do a bit more investigation. The employees who turned in paper timesheets were asked why they weren't using the online tool. Paper was easier, they said. Skeptical, the interviewers asked if they could observe the employees while they filled out the online timesheet. The results were telling. Lots of employees started grousing as soon as they encountered the wizard that was built into the online tool. Ironically, the wizard was intended to help people fill out the form. Think of the annoying paperclip guy in Microsoft Office who wants to help you write a letter. Now, imagine you have no choice but to accept his help. When the executives killed the wizard, allowing people to skip directly to the form itself, compliance rates rose immediately, and within a few weeks, everyone was using the online tool. People weren't being defiant, said Bregman. They were just proceeding on the easiest path. What's sadly typical about this story is that the executives didn't initially look for a path solution. Instead, they wanted to spook the elephant by threatening to withhold a paycheck. Bregman says they were mentally stuck. Well, I already asked them to do it. I taught them how to do it. I told them they had to do it. I don't know what else to do. At that point, the executives felt they'd tried every tool in their toolbox, so they jumped to punishments. We're taught to focus on incentives by our business background, says Bregman. Or even our parents. Do this or you won't get your allowance. But executives and parents often have more tools than they think they have. If you change the path, you'll change the behavior. This clinic demonstrates the issue. Can you get problem students to come to class on time? Situation. Bart Miller, an American history teacher at Lincoln High School in Portland, Oregon, is frustrated by a few of his students, like Robbie and Kent, who frequently arrive late and then sit in the back of the room, talking to each other and laughing and disrupting the class. Miller has tried getting tough with them, being strict and even sending them to the principal a few times. Nothing seems to work. What can he do to get these students under control? Bart Miller and the situation are real, but the kids' names are disguised. What's the switch, and what's holding it back? If Miller tries to get Robbie and Kent to act like model students, he'll be doomed to fail. Let's focus on the critical move. Miller wants Robbie and Kent to be in their seats before the class starts. If he manages to succeed with that, no small feat. He can keep snowballing the change. What's holding back the switch? Let's face it, this probably isn't a rider problem. Robbie and Kent know exactly when they're supposed to be in their seats, so we won't even think about the rider. It's an elephant problem. The kids aren't enthused about showing up on time, especially if doing so means less time hanging out with their friends in the hallways. The path might also play a role. Are there aspects of the environment or culture that make it easier for the kids to get away with their tardiness? How do we make the switch? Direct the rider. Not applicable. The teens know what is expected of them. Motivate the elephant. 1. Find the feeling. Maybe the kids see Miller as an abstract authority figure, rather than as a human being. Imagine a one-on-one conversation with each kid in which Miller says, "I feel stressed out because I'm expected to cover so much material in so little time, and that's how I'm judged. And I know you don't think it's a big deal when you're a few minutes late, but it makes my chances of doing a good job harder and harder. Can you do me a favor and just get here a second or two early?" Depending on the kid's empathy level, this might work, or more likely, will fail utterly. Shape the path. 1. Tweak the environment. Lock the door when the bell rings so latecomers are stuck in the hallway. 2. Build habits. Start having a daily quiz with one or two quick questions at the beginning of every class. If Robbie and Kent aren't present to take the quiz, they'll fail. 3. Rally the herd. Post a class on-time record on the wall. Maybe when Robbie and Kent see that they're the only students violating the social norm to be on time, they'll change their ways. 4. Build habits. Set a policy that the last student in his or her seat every day will be asked to answer the first question. 5. Rally the herd. Find a way to let Robbie and Kent know that the other students dislike what they're doing, as they almost certainly do. Often troublemakers have the illusion that their defiant behavior makes them folk heroes. They can be deflated quickly by frank peer feedback. 6. Tweak the environment. Do what Bart Miller actually did. He bought a used couch and put it right at the front of the classroom. It was immediately obvious that this couch was the cool place to sit. Students could slouch and relax instead of sitting at a dorky desk. Suddenly, Robbie and Kent started getting to class early every day so they could get a good seat. They were volunteering to sit at the front of the classroom. Genius. 4. Becky Richards worked at Kaiser South San Francisco Hospital, where nurses administer about 800 medications a day. Medication administration is what happens between the time a doctor prescribes a certain medication, such as 100 milligrams of ibuprofen, and the patient receives it. Nurses take the doctor's chicken scratch prescription, transcribe it so it's legible, then fax the order to the pharmacy. When the medication arrives from the pharmacy, they deliver it in the right dosage by the right method, IV, drip, injection, orally, to the right patient at the right time. Nurses have an impressive accuracy record. On average, they commit approximately one error per 1,000 medications administered. Still, given the huge volume of medications delivered at Kaiser South, that error rate led to about 250 errors annually, and a single error can be harmful or even deadly. For instance, if a patient receives too much heparin, a blood thinner, the patient's blood will no longer clot and the patient could hemorrhage. If a patient gets too little heparin, the patient could develop a blood clot that could lead to a stroke. Richards, who was director of adult clinical services at Kaiser South, and her nursing staff wanted to drive down medication errors. Richards believed that most errors happened when nurses were distracted. It was easy to become distracted, because in most traditional hospitals, the medication administration areas are right in the middle of the nursing units, which tend to be the noisiest places on the floor. From memory, Richards quoted Tess Pape, a professor at the University of Texas, who has studied medication errors, saying, "Today we admire people for multitasking. We celebrate people who can accomplish many things at once. But when you're giving out medications, it is the last time you should be multitasking." Put yourself in Richard's shoes for a moment. Your goal is clear. Change your nurses' behavior so they can focus better, so they're less likely to get distracted. How can you accomplish that? First, you need to identify the core problem. The nurses understand what's expected of them. The critical moves are clear, so this isn't a rider problem. Nor do the nurses have any emotional resistance to better focus. In fact, it annoys them when they're distracted by others, which means that in this case, we have the luxury of a supportive elephant. The problem, it seems, is the distractions themselves. No one thinks twice before calling out to a nurse who's walking the halls delivering medication. Worse, nurses feel an obligation to respond when others distract them. No one wants to tell a surgeon, "Sorry, bub, can't help right now. I'm dealing with medication." Yet, that's exactly what needs to happen if errors are to be reduced. What Richards needed to do was make other people aware that they were interrupting the nurses. She needed to make the bad behavior visible. Ideally, when the nurses were administering medication, they would work inside a soundproof bubble, like the cone of silence from Get Smart. With that solution being architecturally infeasible, Richards came up with the idea of using a visual symbol, something that could be worn by nurses, that would signal to other people, "Hey, don't bother me right now. I'm passing out medication." After considering armbands and aprons, Richards settled on vests and decided to call them medication vests. Where do you buy a medication vest? Richards had to make do with what she could find. The first vest we ordered was off the internet. It was really cheesy. Cheap plastic. Bright orange. Be careful what you order off the internet. Later, with vests in hand, Richards unveiled the idea to her staff. When you're administering medication, you'll put on a medication vest. It's bright enough that people can see it from down the hall, and all of us, including the doctors, will know that when someone is wearing one of these vests, we should leave that person alone. She selected two units at Kaiser South for a 6-month pilot study of the medication vests, and in July 2006 it began. Richards quickly encountered a problem. The nurses hated the vests. So did the doctors. Nurses thought the vest was demeaning, and they couldn't find it when they needed it, said Richards. They didn't like the color. They'd ask, "How do you clean it?" And physicians hated not being able to talk to their nurses when they passed them in the hall. The nurses' written feedback was scathing. "Oh, so you want to draw attention to the fact that we can make a mistake? You want people to think I have a dunce cap on? That I'm so stupid I can't think on my feet? Give me a hard hat and a cone and I can go work for Caltrans, the state highway department." They were pretty brutal, said Richards. The reception was so universally poor that Richards was ready to write off the idea and try something else. Then the data came back. During the 6-month trial period, errors dropped 47% from the 6 months prior to the study. It took our breath away, said Richards. Once the data were in, the hatred faded. Impressed by the results, the entire hospital adopted the medication vests, except for one unit that insisted they weren't needed. Errors dropped by 20% in the first month of the hospital-wide adoption, except in one unit, which actually saw an increase in errors. Guess which one? You know you've got a smart solution when everyone hates it and it still works. And in fact, works so well that people's hate turns to enthusiasm. Becky Richards had found a way to change the path. 5. The airline industry has long used a consistent practice. Because most aircraft accidents happen during takeoffs and landings, the most hectic and coordination-intensive parts of any flight, the industry adopted the sterile cockpit rule. Anytime a plane is below 10,000 feet, whether on the way up or the way down, no conversation is permitted in the cockpit except what's directly relevant for flying. At 11,000 feet, members of the cockpit crew can talk about football, their kids, or the loathsome passengers, but not at 9,500 feet. One IT group adopted the sterile cockpit concept to advance an important software project. The group had embraced a substantial goal to reduce new product development time from 3 years to 9 months. In previous projects with tight deadlines, the work environment had become increasingly stressful. When workers fell behind schedule, they tended to interrupt their colleagues for quick help, and their managers would wander by regularly and ask to be statused on the project. As a result, the software engineers were interrupted more and more, and work weeks expanded to 60 and 70 hours as people started showing up on weekends, hoping to get some work done without interruption. The leaders of the IT group decided to try an experiment. They established quiet hours on Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday mornings before noon. The goal was to give coders a sterile cockpit, allowing them to concentrate on complex bits of coding without being derailed by periodic interruptions. Even the socially insensitive responded well to this change in the path. One engineer, previously among the worst interrupters, said, "I always used to worry about my own quiet time and how to get more of it, but this experiment made me think about how I'm impacting others." In the end, the group managed to meet its stringent 9-month development goal. The division vice president attributed this accomplishment to the sterile cockpit quiet hours. "I do not think we could have made the deadline without it," he said. "This is a new benchmark. In these disparate environments, airplane cockpits and hospitals and IT work groups, the right behaviors did not evolve naturally. Nurses weren't naturally given enough space to work without distraction, and programmers weren't naturally left alone to focus on coding. Instead, leaders had to reshape the path consciously. With some simple tweaks in the environment, suddenly the right behaviors emerged. It wasn't the people who changed. It was the situation. What looks like a people problem is often a situation problem." 6. We've seen lots of environment tweaking in organizations, offices and airlines and hospitals. But make no mistake, we can turn these tools on ourselves too. Many people have discovered that when it comes to changing their own behavior, environmental tweaks beat self-control every time. For instance, Brian Wansink, the author of the Popcorn Bucket Study described in Chapter 1, has a devoted following of dieters who swear by his prime directive, shrink your dinnerware, use smaller plates, bowls, and cups. Wansink knows that if we use big plates, we feel obligated to cover them with food. A half-full plate feels morally wrong somehow. And because we're wired to finish what's on our plate, that's a big problem. Big plates equal big portions equals overeating. To achieve eating control, according to Wansink, you must start with plate control. Store your dinner plates in a box in your closet, and start eating dinner every night off your salad plates. Use small wine glasses, not huge goblets. Never eat snack food directly out of the bag or box. Instead, pour a reasonable portion on a small appetizer plate. These are very simple environmental tweaks. Swapping out the plates and bowls and glasses in your cabinet have huge effects on eating behavior. We all play these games with ourselves, trying to nudge ourselves to do the right thing. We know a guy who religiously lays out his jogging clothes and shoes before he goes to sleep. That way, when he wakes up, it's just a tiny bit easier to get going. Another friend never goes to bed without setting the coffee pot to auto-brew at wake-up time. The aroma of fresh brewed coffee helps to fight the oversleeping urge. And there's a woman who actually freezes her credit card in a block of ice, so that when she feels the urge to spend, she forces herself to have a cooling off, or rather a warming up period. Self-manipulation works. Amanda Tucker used these same environment tweaking principles to improve her management style at work. Tucker was the country manager for Nike in Vietnam. She traveled frequently to visit factories in outlying regions, and while she was out of the office, work piled up. When she returned home, she was often overwhelmed. "I had more plates spinning than I felt I could handle," she said. It was tempting to shut her office door and plow through the accumulated work, but she knew it was important to stay accessible to her team. In fact, she established an open-door policy, allowing the individuals who reported to her directly to see her at any time she was in town. 9 months into the job, Tucker solicited feedback from her team members about her performance as a manager. She was astonished when they complained that she didn't seem to have time to talk to them. Some of them were offended that when they walked into my office, I would often continue to look at my computer screen and type while they were talking. Of course, this gave them the strong signal that what I was doing was more important to me than they were, Tucker said. She knew they were right. It was a bad habit. And she also knew that the layout of her office was encouraging the habit. When people came in to see her, they sat in chairs across from her desk. When she faced them, she still had the computer monitor in her field of view. So it was easy, too easy, for Tucker to glance back and forth from their faces to the screen. Tucker simply rearranged her office. She moved the desk so it no longer separated her from her guests, and she added a meeting area with two small couches and a table. Now, when she was facing the people who came to see her, the computer was completely out of sight. No more temptation. Just by rearranging the furniture, I was able to connect much better with people who came to see me, she said. 6 months later, she solicited more feedback and was pleased that her communication scores had soared. If you'd seen Tucker's initial performance appraisals, you might have concluded that, despite her stated open-door policy, she was one of those insensitive managers who never listened to their subordinates, and you would have been committing the fundamental attribution error. Simply by rearranging the furniture in her office, Tucker made herself into a different kind of person. That's the power of shaping the path. 7. There is something satisfying about outsmarting ourselves. By now you realize what outsmarting ourselves means, that our riders are outsmarting our elephants. Tucker's solution was appealing in its elegance, a seemingly messy management problem solved by an afternoon office makeover. Tucker shaped her environment to disallow her own bad behavior. This is a topic that hits home for the two of us, your co-authors. While we were writing this book, we got annoyed by our tendency to get distracted by email. We were aware of the irony of our giving advice to readers about reining in their elephants while our own elephants habitually prompted us to check Outlook. So we decided to take some of our own medicine. If you use Microsoft Outlook, you know that when you get new email, an alert sound plays through your computer's speakers. That sound is like digital catnip. How can you not check your mail when you hear it? What if a rich Nigerian politician went down in a plane crash and you had a limited time to capture part of his fortune? Chip decided to tweak his environment. He rummaged through the control panel until he found the place that allowed him to delete the email sound at the system level. Later he noticed that new email also triggered an alert icon on the taskbar. More irresistible bait for the elephant. He covered it with a post-it note blackened with one of his daughter's felt-tip markers. Now it can't torment him. Ignorance is bliss. Meanwhile, Dan went nuclear. He bought an old laptop, deleted all its browsers, and for good measure, deleted its wireless network drivers. Now, when he needs to focus, he takes the Wayback Machine with him to a coffee shop or library. There's no hope of getting online. He's been liberated by this restriction. Our struggles with email are a bit pathetic, but the larger topic is worth considering. Is it possible to design an environment in which undesired behaviors, whether yours or your colleagues, are made not only harder but impossible? As it turns out, lots of people actually make their living contemplating how to wipe out the wrong kinds of behaviors. Consider industrial safety. Many factories use dangerous machines that have a bad habit of lopping off fingers or hands that are in the wrong place at the wrong time. Suppose you're a factory foreman, and one of your workers loses an index finger in an industrial accident. You want to make sure this never happens again. How might you accomplish that? You could give your workers' riders clear direction by means of clear signage. Keep hands clear of the machine, or danger, risk of injury, accompanied by an illustration identifying the machine's trouble spot. You could appeal to your workers' elephants, using fear. Here we can take inspiration from driver's education courses in which teenagers watch films full of bloody, gruesome car crashes, so that when they finish driver's ed, they will avoid driving like teenagers. In homage to these films, you could call together your workers and show them a video of the guy who lost his finger. Show them what the gory wound looked like. Have him urge his colleagues to take safety seriously. I wish I'd paid more attention, he'd say. Or you could focus on the path, in which case you would disregard hearts and minds entirely. In fact, suppose you stipulated outright that your workers are hopeless, that they're irredeemable daredevils who are determined to waggle their fingers in the machine's danger zone for the sheer sport of it. Could you still keep them from dismembering themselves? Absolutely. Many factories have done exactly that. For instance, one machine is designed so that it can be activated only if two buttons are pressed at the same time. The buttons are positioned so that to press both of them, you must place your arms high and wide, like the Y in the YMCA dance. The beauty of this arrangement is that if your hands are pressing those buttons, they are, by design, nowhere near the danger zone. And if they're not pressing the buttons, The machine is off. Either way, your fingers win. Poof. You have made a dangerous behavior impossible. 8. With that example in mind, think about all the innovations that have made bad behavior impossible, or nearly impossible. Child-proof caps on medicine bottles, cars that won't shift out of park unless the brake pedal is pressed, anything that's fireproof. Notice that these are product design innovations created to prevent injuries. Injury prevention is, in fact, a thriving field. Every state government has a few people on staff, usually heinously underfunded, whose job is to think about how to reduce injuries or deaths caused by small children falling into swimming pools, the elderly falling in their homes, car crashes, and other misfortunes. Rarely can such incidents be made impossible, but injuries resulting from them can be reduced. In trying to minimize the risk of bad outcomes, injury prevention experts often turn to the Haddon Matrix, a simple framework that provides a way to think systematically about accidents by highlighting three key periods of time: pre-event, event, and post-event. Let's say our goal is to reduce serious injuries from car wrecks. Pre-event interventions would include anything that would tend to prevent wrecks from happening: installing bright lighting on highways, painting clear lane markers on the roads, popularizing anti-lock brakes, launching advertising campaigns against drunk driving. With event interventions, we accept that crashes will happen and ask ourselves how we can reduce the chances of injury. Seat belts and airbags are classic event interventions, but also think about breakaway light poles and those big orange barrels that line exit ramps, which are intended to soften collisions. With post-event interventions, we acknowledge both that the crashes will occur and that people will be injured. The goal of the post-event interventions is to minimize the severity of the injuries and optimize the health outcomes. A speedy, effective emergency medical team will be important. The Haddon Matrix is also useful for thinking about matters that aren't so life and death. Let's say you are the IT person in a small business, and one of your many duties is to prevent loss of important data that occurs frequently when computers crash. Some IT support people in this situation embrace not the Haddon Matrix, but the Hectoring Manifesto, and berate their colleagues for not backing up their work, all the while committing the fundamental attribution error: my colleagues are reckless and lazy people. But if you think in Haddon Matrix terms, you begin to see a more holistic picture. Think about pre-event interventions. If computers don't crash, then you can't lose data. So maybe you should schedule monthly computer checkups, buy extra padded laptop bags for everyone, and budget for complete replacements every 3 years. Event interventions would call for ways of preventing a crash from leading to data loss. For instance, some computers have an extra hard drive where all data are mirrored in real time. A crash would be less likely to take out both drives. Post-event interventions would accept the reality of data loss, but focus on ways to minimize the damage. The most obvious strategy here would be to create an automated nightly network backup, so that if a crash happens and data are lost, you can restore the previous night's data. Another post-event strategy would be to find ways to prevent mission-critical data from ever ending up on a laptop. For instance, you might use an online application such as Salesforce.com to host customer contact information, so that precious data would never depend on the health of a local hard drive. Note, we've managed to create a robust plan against data loss without worrying about what our employees are thinking or feeling. We didn't mention their elephants or their riders. We simply tweaked the environment to make bad behavior impossible. 9. In 1999, some bad behavior was abruptly made impossible at a company called Rackspace. At one particular moment, company employees stopped doing one thing and started doing another thing, and that behavior shift became the most important inflection point in the company's history. But before we get to that moment, a bit of backstory is necessary. Rackspace is a company that hosts internet sites for other companies. It prides itself on customer service, as suggested by its slogan, "Fanatical Support." The firm's focus on customer service has paid off. Over the years, Rackspace has won an armload of trade awards for its service, and its Net Promoter Score, a commonly used benchmark of customer word of mouth, has consistently been the envy of the industry. But Rackspace wasn't always so customer friendly. 1999, Rackspace didn't think much about customer service. Company founder Graham Weston said that in the early days, Rackspace had a denial-of-service business model. Customer service interactions were viewed as costs to be minimized. The more roadblocks that could be erected to keep the phone from ringing, the better the profits would be. Notice the uncomfortable echoes of the Haddon Matrix. If you view customer calls as bad behavior to be prevented, you will do all you can to deter them. Recall that for many years, Amazon.com's policy was not to publish a customer service phone number. Then, in the fall of 1999, Rackspace received the call. It started normally enough. A customer tried to call for support. He pressed 5 to get help. But instead he got voicemail, which in effect said, "Feel free to leave a voicemail here, but we don't check it very often, so you're better off sending us an email." The customer grudgingly sent an email message to the suggested address, and the team at Rackspace never answered it. After a few more of these irritating cycles, the customer was furious, and with a bit of legwork, he managed to track down Graham Weston at the office of a real estate business he owned. Surprised, Weston asked the customer to forward the emails he'd sent and promised to look into the matter. Weston reviewed the long chain of emails, which had become increasingly angry as past inquiries were ignored. "Something hit me about what the customer was asking for," said Weston. "It was something we could do very easily that he couldn't do. So the question in my mind was, why are we not serving the customer happily?" Weston knew that his team couldn't sustain a business based on dodging its customers. "We made a 180-degree turn," he said. Weston hired David Bryce to be the head of customer support. At his first meeting with the team, Bryce announced that Rackspace was going to transform itself from a company that dreaded customer support to a company that was passionate about support. He posted an aspirational banner on the wall. "Rackspace gives fanatical support." The phrase stuck immediately. This was just talk, of course, but there was action to back it up. Weston started by overhauling the company's business model. Providing great service would cost more, and if Rackspace offered both premium service and cutting-edge technological expertise, it would be forced to set its prices so high that no one would buy. So remarkably, Weston began pushing for the company to become technologically dull. "We don't want to be on the bleeding edge of technology. We believe in standardization. We want a narrow focus. These are the things we do, and these are the things we don't. If you're E-Trade or Amazon, you should host your own site. We can't help," he said. Notice that this is a clear direction for the rider. Perhaps the most dramatic change made by Weston and Bryce was also the simplest. Rackspace, like all hosting companies, had a call queuing system. "Your call is important to us. Please press 1 for recorded tips that don't address your problem. Press 5 to leave us a message we won't return. Press 8 to repeat these options." The call queue is perhaps the most basic tool of customer support. Weston threw it out. "When a customer calls, that means they need our help, and we've got to answer the telephone," he said. Without the queuing system, there was no safety net. The phone would keep ringing until somebody picked it up. To Weston, this was a critical symbol of the service ethic. "When a customer has a problem, we shouldn't deal with it when it's convenient for us. We should deal with it when it's convenient for the customer." When Weston threw out the queuing system, it became impossible to dodge the customer. By 2007, the company was talking to an average customer 3 times per week. Subsequently, the company launched the Straightjacket Awards, including actual Rackspace-branded straitjackets as trophies, which were presented to employees who'd been so fanatical about service that they'd become downright insane. That's an identity appeal for the elephant. "We are zealots. That's what makes us special." Not coincidentally, in 2008, Rackspace was one of the companies in Fortune's list of best places to work. The focus on service paid off. In 2001, Rackspace was the first internet hosting firm to turn a profit, and over the next 6 years, it averaged 58% annual growth. By 2008, Rackspace had passed AT&T as the highest-grossing firm in the industry. 10. What transformed the character of Rackspace's customer service people? Nothing. They had the same core character before and after the change. They were just people operating in a new environment. The old behavior, ignoring customers, had become harder, and the new behavior, serving customers, had become easier. In this chapter, we've seen that what looks like a character problem is often correctable when you change the environment. The transformations are stunning. Take a bunch of customer service slackers and rip out their call queuing system, and they start helping customers. Take a boss whose employees say she won't listen and rejigger her furniture, and suddenly the employees' frustrations fade. Take the biggest jerks in the Stanford dorms and give them a page of instructions, and they'll donate more food to the needy than the saints. Simple tweaks of the path can lead to dramatic changes in behavior. Chapter 9. Build Habits. 1. Mike Romano was born in 1950 and raised in Milwaukee, the youngest of four brothers. His dad was a handyman who fixed plumbing and heating fixtures. His mom had a commercial art degree. She stayed at home to raise the boys, taking jobs from time to time to pay the bills. Romano had a temper. In high school, when he was 18, he got into a fight and threw a guy through a window. Afraid of what would happen in court, he enlisted in the army. He figured he was going to be drafted anyway. The court let him go. Romano eventually ended up being assigned to the 173rd Airborne Brigade in Vietnam, an elite and well-respected unit of paratroopers. The soldiers of the 173rd had an open secret, however: rampant drug use. Others nicknamed them jumping junkies. Coming into the military, Romano had no real drug experience. He tried to keep his nose clean with the jumping junkies. A few months after he arrived in Vietnam, a Claymore landmine detonated near him, and he was struck in his right hand, forearm, and foot. He was taken to a hospital in Cameron Bay for recovery. That was where he first tried opium. He quickly became hooked, like so many others around him. Even when he transferred to other hospitals, his supply wasn't interrupted. He mostly smoked opium-laced joints. But it was also easy to find liquid opium, and even opium chewing gum, not to mention other drugs such as LSD and marijuana. His addiction continued to torment him throughout his 13-month tour of duty. Romano's fall into drug use was a typical story during the Vietnam War. The White House was so troubled by reports of drug use among soldiers that it commissioned a study to investigate the scope of the problem. The results were disturbing. Before the war, the typical soldier had only casual experience with hard drugs, and less than 1% had ever been addicted to narcotics. But once in Vietnam, almost half of the soldiers tried narcotics and 20% became addicted. Demographics did not predict who would become drug users in Vietnam. Race and class were irrelevant. The drug use started early. 20% of all users started in their first week in Vietnam, 60% within the first 3 months. Oddly, drug use did not seem to be triggered by trauma. The researchers found no statistical relationship between drug use and the difficulty of soldiers' assignments, or the danger they faced, or the death of friends. Unlike most soldiers, Romano started using opium because he was injured. For most soldiers in Vietnam, drugs were simply a fact of life, a part of the culture. Government officials were terrified by what would happen when thousands of drug addicts began to return to America. Military and civilian leaders worried that the country's drug treatment programs would be flooded, stretched beyond capacity. They worried that vets might not be able to hold down jobs, that they might turn to crime. Mike Romano was one of the people the officials were worried about. When he finally boarded his flight back to the United States in 1969, headed home to Milwaukee, he smuggled back with him a stash of opium-laced joints. Then his life began to change. A week or two after his return home, he was driving with friends in town when he saw a girl he'd known in grade school. "Stop the car," he said. He chased her down. She was working as a counter girl at a nearby drugstore. "I thought she was very beautiful," said Romano. The two started dating. She caught on fairly quickly that Romano was an addict, and she put pressure on him to stop. He tried quite a few times, but each time he started to feel sick as withdrawal pains kicked in. And then he'd begin using again. Meanwhile, he started work, construction and house painting and other temporary jobs, and he started taking art classes at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. He got a job there designing promotional posters for bands who played at the student union. After a few quit and relapse cycles, he began to wean himself off opium, and within a month, he was clean. He hasn't touched opium since. What we see in Mike Romano's life seems like an almost impossible change story. An opium addict who recovered, Mike Romano was one of the lucky ones. 2. Or was he? White House researchers continued to investigate the drug problem among returning soldiers, and a puzzle started to emerge. Following up with the troops who returned home, the investigators called them 8 to 12 months after their return to ask about their ongoing drug use. During the war, 50% of soldiers had been casual users, and 20% had become seriously addicted, meaning that they used drugs more than once a week for an extended period of time and experienced withdrawal symptoms, chills, cramps, pain, if they tried to stop. But when the investigators conducted the follow-up, what they found blew their minds. Only 1% of the vets were still addicted to drugs. That was essentially the same rate as existed before the war. The feared drug-fueled social catastrophe had not occurred. What had happened? 3. People are incredibly sensitive to the environment and the culture, to the norms and expectations of the communities they are in. We all want to wear the right clothes, to say the right things, to frequent the right places. Because we instinctively try to fit in with our peer group, behavior is contagious, sometimes in surprising ways. Imagine that your job was to design an environment that would extinguish drug addiction. You could take drug-addicted U.S. soldiers, drop them into this environment, and feel confident that the forces within it would act powerfully to help them beat their habits. Think of this environment as an anti-drug theme park, and assume that you can spend as much as you want to construct it. What would your theme park look like? It might look a whole lot like Romano's neighborhood in Milwaukee. You'd want to surround the former soldiers with people who love them and care about them, who treat them as the drug-free persons they once were. You'd give them interesting work to do, perhaps designing posters for rock bands, so that their minds would be distracted from the joys of opium. You'd create well-publicized sanctions against drug use. You'd keep the drug economy underground, making the former soldiers sneak around to obtain and use drugs. You'd make sure their girlfriends gave them a hard time about their drug use. You'd set up social taboos so that the soldiers would feel derelict, even pathetic, if they kept using. You'd remove the contagious drug-using behavior from the environment. No more addicted soldiers around, and replace it with contagious drug-free behavior. And you would provide rich environmental cues, sights, songs, food, clothes, and homes that remind the former soldiers of their pre-war drug-free identities. The Milwaukee theme park. That's exactly why Mike Romano became a former addict. When Romano relocated to Milwaukee, his environment changed, and the new environment changed him. 4. As the Romano story shows, one of the subtle ways in which our environment acts on us is by reinforcing or deterring our habits. When we think about habits, most of the time we're thinking about bad ones, biting our fingernails, procrastinating, eating sweets when we're anxious, and so on. But of course we also have plenty of good habits. Jogging, praying, brushing our teeth. Why are habits so important? They are, in essence, behavioral autopilot. They allow lots of good behaviors to happen without the rider taking charge. Remember that the rider's self-control is exhaustible, so it's a huge plus if some positive things can happen free on autopilot. To change yourself or other people, you've got to change habits. And what we see with Romano is that his habits shifted when his environment shifted. This makes sense. Our habits are essentially stitched into our environment. Research bears this out. According to one study of people making changes in their lives, 36% of the successful changes were associated with a move to a new location, and only 13% of unsuccessful changes involved a move. Many smokers, for example, find it easier to quit when they're on vacation because at home, every part of their environment is loaded with smoking associations. It's like trying to quit smoking inside a Camel advertisement. Everywhere you look are reminders of the habit. There's that drawer in the kitchen where the lighters are stashed, the clay pot in the porch that's become an archive of ashes, the ever-present scent of smoke in the car, and the closet. When a smoker goes on vacation, the environment recedes toward neutrality. That doesn't mean it's easy to quit, but it's easier. It's unrealistic, however, to think that most of us can shift our environment so dramatically. If you're trying to change your team's habits at work, then, yes, relocating your office would be a big help. Good luck selling that idea. What are some more practical ways to create a habit? The first thing to realize is that even small environmental tweaks can make a difference. That's what we saw in Chapter 8. Remember how Amanda Tucker rearranged her office to make it easier for her to listen to her employees? That was the first step in establishing a new habit. Environmental tweaks can even force a habit, as we saw in the Rackspace example. When the call queuing system was thrown out, the customer service staffers quickly developed the habit of answering the phone. But forming a habit isn't all environmental, it's also mental. It would be very difficult, for instance, to tweak the environment in a way that would compel you to learn how to play the piano. So, how do you lay the mental groundwork for a new habit? 5. Say that you've been putting off going to the gym. So you resolve to yourself, tomorrow morning, right after I drop off Anna at school, I'll head straight to the gym. Let's call this mental plan an action trigger. You've made the decision to execute a certain action, working out, when you encounter a certain situational trigger, the school circle, tomorrow morning. Peter Goldwitzer, a psychologist at New York University, is the pioneer of work in this area. He and his colleague, Veronica Brandstatter, found that action triggers are quite effective in motivating action. In one study, they tracked college students who had the option to earn extra credit in the class by writing a paper about how they spent Christmas Eve. But there was a catch. To earn the credit, they had to submit the paper by December 26th. Most students had good intentions of writing the paper, but only 33% of them got around to writing and submitting it. Other students in the study were required to set action triggers, to note in advance exactly when and where they intended to write the report. For example, I'll write this report in my dad's office on Christmas morning before everyone gets up. A whopping 75% of those students wrote the report. That's a pretty astonishing result for such a small mental investment. Does this mean that simply by imagining a time and place where you'll do something, you'll increase the likelihood that you'll actually do it? Yes and no. Action triggers won't get you or anyone else to do something you truly don't want to do. An action trigger never would have convinced college students to participate in an online calculus camp on Christmas Day. But as the extra credit study demonstrates, action triggers can have a profound power to motivate people to do things they know they need to do. Peter Goldwitzer argues that the value of action triggers resides in the fact that we are preloading a decision. Dropping off Anna at school triggers the next action, going to the gym. There's no cycle of conscious deliberation. By preloading the decision, we conserve the writer's self-control. The concept of preloading is easier to see with an example. Imagine that you are one of the college students in Goldwitzer's study. It's Christmas time, and you're at home. Your parents are doting on you, and your siblings are having an interesting conversation. The TV is on, the Christmas tree is lit up, and your elderly Chihuahua Fredo is staring at you adoringly. Let's not forget the food. Turkey and dressing, pecan pie, chocolate truffles, and Guitar Hero, and naps, and the calls you're getting from old high school friends. Distractions everywhere. So if you walk into this buffet line of stimuli, and you haven't preloaded a decision about your extra credit report, if you haven't told yourself, I'll do this report in my dad's office on Christmas morning before everyone gets up, you are sunk. That's why action triggers have unexpected value. Goldwitzer says that when people pre-decide, they pass the control of their behavior onto the environment. Goldwitzer says that action triggers protect goals from tempting distractions, bad habits, or competing goals. There are countless ways to use action triggers at work. If your salespeople are more motivated to close new business than to cultivate existing relationships, give them a coffee and call trigger. Tell them that whenever they pour their first cup of coffee, they are to place a check-in call to one of their most important customers. Or think about your employees who will be attending an industry conference. By the time they get back to the office, their email will be so backed up that they won't be in the mood to share their learnings. So give them an action trigger. Suggest that during the flight home, whenever the okay to use electronics announcement is made, they type up some reflections for everyone on the team. action triggers simply have to be specific enough and visible enough to interrupt people's normal stream of consciousness. A trigger to praise your employees when they do something great is too vague to be useful. Goldwitzer has shown that action triggers are most useful in the most difficult situations, the ones that are most draining to the writer's self-control. One study analyzed people's success in accomplishing easy goals or hard goals. With easy goals, the use of action triggers increased success only slightly, from 78% to 84%. But with hard goals, action triggers almost tripled the chance of success. Goal completion skyrocketed from 22% to 62%. To see how action triggers can aid people in difficult times, consider a study of patients recovering from hip or knee replacement surgery. On average, the patients were 68 years old, and they had been in pain for about a year and a half before the surgery. The surgeries initially make things even worse. They take such a toll on the body that the patients require assistance with the basic tasks of daily life, such as bathing, getting into bed, or even standing up. The road to recovery can be long and painful. All patients aspired to get back on their feet as soon as possible, of course. But patients in one group were asked to set action triggers. For instance, if you are going to go for a walk this week, please write down when and where you plan to walk. The results of the study were dramatic. On average, action trigger patients were bathing themselves without assistance in 3 weeks. Other patients took 7 weeks. Action trigger patients were standing up in 3.5 weeks. The others took 7.7 weeks. In just over 1 month, the action trigger patients were getting in and out of a car on their own. The others took 2.5 months. Goldwitzer says that, in essence, what action triggers do is create an instant habit. Habits are behavioral autopilot, and that's exactly what action triggers are setting up. Here's the proof of the instant habit concept. One study showed that the single biggest predictor of whether women gave themselves a monthly breast examination was if they had a habit of doing so. When another group of women who didn't have such a habit were asked to set action triggers, they ended up doing just as well as the women with long-time habits. By preloading a decision, they created an instant habit. Action triggers are not foolproof, of course. Teens with a serious smoking habit, for example, did not reap any benefit from setting action triggers to quit smoking. Their nicotine-enhanced habit was simply too strong. But even though action triggers aren't perfect, it's hard to imagine an easier way to make an immediate change more likely. A recent meta-study that analyzed 8,155 participants across 85 studies found that the typical person who set an action trigger did better than 74% of people on the same task who didn't set one. Instant habits. This is a rare point of intersection between the aspirations of self-help and the reality of science, and you can't get much more practical. The next time your team resolves to act in a new way, challenge team members to take it further. Have them specify when and where they're going to put the plan in motion. Get them to set an action trigger. Then, set another one for yourself. Here's a clinic that illustrates this. How can you get workers to respect a new safety policy? Situation. Patty Poppy is a department manager in the General Motors Automotive Plant in Lordstown, Ohio, and she is struggling with how to roll out a new safety policy. Her department, composed of 950 people, is responsible for welding big pieces of metal onto the skeletal car frames. The work can be dangerous. The edges of the metal are sharp when they come off the presses. If a worker puts his hand on an edge and leans against it, the metal will slice his hand. For that reason, gloves and protective clothing are essential. Also, welders wear goggles, but they are sometimes hurt when sparks fly into their eyes from the side. So the new policy prescribes goggles with protective side shields. The old safety policy was complex and filled with exceptions. For instance, a worker driving a forklift didn't have to wear safety equipment. Poppy says everyone thinks they'll fall under the "this doesn't apply to me" clause. She is determined to get everyone to take the new policy seriously. This was a real situation. What's the switch and what's holding it back? Poppy wants the workers to protect themselves from lacerations and sparks. There are three potential barriers. First, the complexity of the old policy may have deterred some workers from embracing it. Remember that what looks like resistance is often a lack of clarity. Poppy needs to script the critical moves. Second, in any safety situation, a macho vibe often comes into play. That's an identity problem. If it seems manlier to ditch the goggles than to wear them, then the elephant will resist. Third, social pressure is working against safety because of the "this doesn't apply to me" sentiment. Poppy needs to flip that social norm. Also, might there be ways to use the environment to cue the right behaviors? How do we make the switch? Direct the writer. 1. Script the critical moves. Poppy threw out the old complicated policy and boiled down the new safety policy to 2 specific behaviors. 1. Everyone is required to wear hard side shields and safety glasses. 2. No one can expose any bare skin, no shorts or short-sleeved shirts. That's it. Then Poppy found a way to make these rules very concrete. At an all-hands meeting, she hosted a safety game show. A worker was called on stage to be the contestant. He was asked to assess whether a series of models was in compliance with the new safety rules. Some of the models violated the code in subtle ways, such as wearing safety glasses with one eyepiece missing. She invited audience members to help the contestant, and they shouted out answers, thereby rehearsing and absorbing the new behaviors expected of them. 2. Point to the destination. Poppy worried about rationalization, the excuse that "this doesn't apply to me." So she created a B&W goal to eliminate the wiggle room. If you were in the plant, you were required to follow the 2 rules, regardless of what you were doing. The rules apply to everyone at all times. Motivate the elephant. 1. Grow your people. Macho men don't like to wear dorky safety glasses. Maybe Poppy could find glasses that look more like Bono's and less like a junior high school shop teacher's. That might make the change less of an identity threat. Shape the path. 1. Rally the herd. By requiring everyone in the plant to wear the safety gear at all times, Poppy is flipping the social norm in favor of compliance. When you look around and everyone is wearing safety glasses, you are more likely to wear them yourself. 2. Build habits. Poppy added 1 final inspired touch. She painted a large blue line around the plant and made the new safety policy effective anywhere inside the line. Also at the entry points, she posted blue wooden men who were wearing the appropriate gear. By installing the blue line and the blue men, Poppy was basically introducing an action trigger. She was training the workers to think, "When I cross this line, that's my cue to put on my gear." The action trigger helped make the behavior habitual. What happened? As a result of Poppy's innovations, injuries at the plant dropped 21% from previous levels, which were already among the best of manufacturers doing similar work. 6. Habits are behavioral autopilot, and that's why they're such a critical tool for leaders. Leaders who can instill habits that reinforce their team's goals are essentially making progress for free. They've changed behavior in a way that doesn't draw down the writer's reserves of self-control. Habits will form inevitably, whether they're formed intentionally or not. You've probably created lots of team habits unwittingly. If your staff meetings always start out with genial small talk, then you've created a habit. You've designed your meeting autopilot to yield a few minutes of warm-up small talk. The hard question for a leader is not how to form habits, but which habits to encourage. General William Gus Pagonis led the logistics operation for the Gulf War under President George H.W. Bush. Pagonis was responsible for moving 550,000 troops halfway around the world, along with all of their equipment. His team made the arrangements to serve 122 million meals, pump 1.3 billion gallons of fuel, and deliver 32,000 tons of mail. Even a Walmart executive would get spooked thinking about this. Needless to say, clear and efficient communication was essential. Every morning, General Pagonis held a meeting that started at 8 a.m. and ended at 8:30. No great innovation there, but Pagonis made two changes to the routine. First, he allowed anyone to attend, and he required that at least one representative from each functional group be present. That way, he could ensure a free and open exchange of information across the organization. Second, he required everyone to stand up during the whole meeting. Here's Pagonis on the benefits of the stand-up meeting. Early on, I discovered that making people stand up keeps the ball moving at a quicker pace. People speak their piece and then quickly yield the floor to the next person. On the rare occasion that someone starts to get long-winded or wax philosophic, an unmistakable kind of body language begins to sweep through the crowd. People shift from foot to foot, fidget, look at their watches, and pretty quickly, the conversation comes back into focus. I can't recall the last time I had to crack the whip. The peer group has great power. Pagonis was consciously creating a habit. Any meeting format he chose would have quickly become habitual. It would have been just as easy for him to enshrine a two-hour seated blab fest. What's exciting here is not the existence of the habit, but rather the insight that the habit should serve the mission. When you've got 550,000 troops to relocate, you need focus and clarity and efficiency. A stand-up meeting won't guarantee any of that, but it will help, and it's free. It's not any harder to create than the Blabfest would have been. Similar stand-up meetings are used in agile programming projects in Silicon Valley, which place a premium on quick collaboration.